this on. Okay. Okay, so big picture, this is the 10th of 9 times. We're going to begin to look at Jacob's generations from here forward. Now, there's some interesting big picture ideas, and frankly, we're going to spend most of today kind of introducing this final section. As I was studying it, there's a lot of great stuff in chapter 37, which we will get to, but there are some bigger themes that are kind of playing out over this final section, and I kind of think of them as different camera angles or different ways that you can look at the proceedings and the events in these final chapters. So there are three of them in total. And the first one is the camera angle of promise. Okay, we can look at these chapters through the lens of promise. So in 37 to 50, God's promises to Abraham and the complete preparation of Israel to become God's nation of promise starts to take hold. Okay, so if you got your Bibles with you, turn back to Genesis 15 for a second. Let me just kind of set this up for you. Remember, as we started with Abraham back in chapter 12, he received a number of promises or covenant promises from God. And then we get to this chapter 15, which is a pretty momentous chapter, as we recall. So I'm going to just pick it up in verse 5 and kind of quickly read through it. Again, God is appearing to Abram, still Abram at this point. He's about to get renamed Abraham. And he starts in verse 5. He says, he took him outside and said, now look toward the heavens and count the stars, if you are able to count them. And he said to him, so your descendants shall be. So remember, he was promised many descendants, okay? He's got a small family at this point in time and no personal heir. So these promises sound strange to him. Then we see this great statement of faith by Abraham in verse 6. Then he believed, or he was caused to believe in the Lord, and he reckoned it to him as righteousness. So we see that grace really pervades the entire Bible in terms of the means of salvation. Now, he believed in what he was told. Did he have a full understanding of Messiah at this point? No. But he believed the promises and the things that he was told. David, if there are no more chairs, there's some of these blue ones you can grab up front here. Is anything back there? Sorry. Those are for pizza later. This is the remedial table. If you can sit over here.
I just want to sit in the window.
That's right. Yeah. You've been to my classes before. You know there's a chance it'll go long and you will fall asleep and fall out. Maybe we can get one back here for Lucy also. Lucy, you're going to bring one back. We'll bring one back for you, Lucy.
Here, I'll take it from
David. David.
Right here.
David.
I'll take it.
Okay. Well. I'd rather not go.
Bang anybody's head. Okay, we don't want to have any stitches on our first day. All right, so we start there, okay, so the statement of faith. Then he goes in verse 7, and he said to him, I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to possess it. He said, O Lord God, how may I know that I will possess it? So he said to him, bring me a 3-year-old heifer and a 3-year-old female goat and a 3-year-old ram and a turtle dove and a young pigeon. Then he brought all of these to him and cut them in two and laid each other opposite, but he did not cut the birds. The birds of prey came down upon the carcasses, and Abram drove them away. Now when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram, and behold, terror and great darkness fell upon him. God said to Abram, here's the key thing, know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed for 400 years. Okay, so we have this prophetic statement here, right up front. That's the first part of what he's reaffirming. Okay, then it goes on in 14, but I will also judge the nation whom they will serve. Obviously, we know that. We're going to see that when we get into the book of Exodus and serve. And afterwards, they will come out with many possessions. As for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You'll be buried a good old age. And the fourth generation, they will return here, for the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete. So we get a lot of interesting information there. Okay, why that long? Well, God wants the iniquity of the existing inhabitants of the land to be complete. So he's fully justified when he judges them and installs the Israelites in the nation. But this is where we get this first definitive statement that they will go down to a land, and they will be enslaved there for 400 years. Now remember, they're in Canaan right now, right? So something's got to cause them to get down there to Egypt. And so as we move into this final section here, particularly in chapter 37, we're going to see the catalytic event for that kicks off this chain of events that's going to bring the nation down to Egypt. And then, as we know in the broader story, once they get there, what happens? They get quarantined in Goshen. They become many thousands or hundreds of thousands of people. They become enslaved. And then God, of course, comes in and redeems them and brings them back to the land. So we kind of see this unfolding plan here as we're moving through it. So this first kind of essence of looking at it is we're going to begin to see in these chapters the promise. So we're going to note first that Jacob's patriarchy is told primarily through the life of Joseph, but it is Jacob's generations nonetheless. And these chapters 37 to 50 are going to record how God worked through Joseph to first initiate and then fulfill those promises that we just read quickly back in chapter 15. Now, when we first start the final section, you've got to remember Israel is a small family. It's not even really the nation yet. It's just the new name. It's about 70 people, which we know from Genesis 42 when they talk about them going down. God selected one of the 70 who would be the primary catalyst for getting the nation down to Israel. So we start with the easy questions. For the new people, when you see red, that's the responsive part of the teaching. So who was it that he selected, and what did he do to catalyze this chain of events to get them down to Egypt? Who did God select? Okay, that's a puffball question. That should be easy right there. Joseph, okay. And what was the event? Well, famine, yeah, but what before that? You're kind of ahead of the game. He got sold into slavery, okay? The famine didn't come till later, right? At least the prediction of that, but he sold him into slavery. So he got one of the 70 down to Egypt, and that kind of begins to catalyze this change of events. Now, there's actually a second and subtly important person who is also a catalyst. Now, who is this? This is a little trickier. Who is this, and what was that event? And you got to move a little ahead from chapter 37.
Brother.
What's that?
His brother,
yeah, okay. Partially, that's the thing later. But what happens in chapter 38?
Judah.
We have Judah and Tamar. And what does Judah do?
He leaves home.
What's that?
He leaves home.
Well, but what does he do particularly? He marries a Canaanite woman, right?
Right.
Okay, so we have kind of this secondary catalytic event, and that is, why was it recorded and important? And it's because to show the nation's risk of ethnic purity by staying in the land. Okay, so we've got this issue where one of the brothers don't all have a great track record, but one of them has now gone and intermarried with the land. What does God want? He wants to maintain ethnic purity within the family. So we have this kind of secondary. Joseph is certainly the primary catalyst, okay? But we have this secondary catalyst for getting them to a different location, prompting God to get them out of Canaan, and he does quarantine them effectively, if you think about it, right? So when they go to Egypt, they get a special territory where they are and where they are then expand as a people group, and they're within their people group there. So again, we have this issue of God protecting the purity or the ethnic purity of the nation in the process. In fact, as we get to Genesis 38, you'll see it's kind of almost a parenthetical chapter, almost like Genesis 36 was. Okay, so then from chapter 39 onward, we're going to see God's providential hand in the life of Joseph to bring about the fulfillment of these promises. And it's a lot of different things that God does, right? He protects him. We see a lot of providence. Now, a lot of the commentators make a big deal saying this is the most providential example of God's hand in this chapter 37. And I have to say, yeah, it's true. But what about Abram? What about Abraham? What about Isaac? I mean, the whole book is providential in terms of how God is bringing things about. I don't think there's anything more providential about what we see in this chapter. But we certainly see a series of events where God's hand plays into Joseph's life to bring about his purposes of redemption. Now, the second camera angle is a structural camera angle, okay, a structural one. 37 commences this one long narrative, and it's comprised of multiple acts and scenes with Joseph at the center of each one of them, okay? So Genesis and 37 in particular, as I said, initiates this chain of events of bringing them down to Egypt. It presents kind of the third act of the patriarchal history recorded in Genesis. You say, okay, so what? Well, pull you back to the wide angle view again. As I said earlier, Genesis 1 to 11, we traverse the pre-patriarchal history. Genesis 1 and 2, we had the creation, 3 to 5, the fall, flood, dispersion. And then in Genesis 12, we embark upon this patriarchal history in the book, okay? First Abram, who became Abraham, renamed Genesis 12 to 24. Kind of a little snippet vignette, it almost seems like, on Isaac, only a couple chapters devoted to him, although we see much about his life in the events of what he did with his father Abraham before. And then Jacob through Joseph in these final chapters of the book. Okay, so what again? Well, here's the so what. Overlaying the patriarchal structure, what we have is a theological redemptive structure to the book in terms of what we're looking at. So in 12 to 36, what we had primarily through the first two patriarchs was the revelation of God's redemptive promises and plans. And now in these final chapters, we're going to begin to see the outworking of the redemptive plan. Okay, so 12 to 36, God makes the promises. 37 to 50, we're going to start to see the outworking of those promises and the fulfillment of those promises, which is then going to obviously occupy all of the rest of the Bible, but specifically the Pentateuch and the things that happen there. So that's the second one. The third camera angle is what I call biographical. And it may really be the most fascinating one of the three. So kind of a biographical camera angle. So Joseph's life is a vivid illustration of one key aspect in God's redemptive plan. What's key about Joseph's life? What do you see in his life?
Forgiveness.
What's that?
Forgiveness.
Yeah, forgiveness. That's a big quality of his, right? What else do you see about Joseph himself?
Faithfulness to God.
Faithfulness to God, no question. You guys are getting to the character attributes, so we may have to jump quickly past this one. That's good. Yeah.
There's no sin recorded on the one that God provided to redeem them.
Well, that's interesting. That's a very good point, and the commentators do talk about that. We see in Jacob, you know, a much better character. Now, we know he has sin, but to your point, you're quite right, and this will get to my point in just a second. But what we really see with him is what? Suffering for righteousness' sake, right? Which finally triumphs. Now, this really is the core attribute of the people that God uses to work with, right? We certainly see this in the Messiah. Gets to Bill's comment in a second. We'll look at these parallels in just a minute. But if you think of all of the Old Testament prophets, you think of the apostles in the New Testament, you think of the Messiah, it's characteristic that they suffer. For what? The sake of righteousness. But yet God uses that, and they finally triumph. Okay, God triumphs through them in the various things that we do. So we see this kind of key attribute in him. So it has many parallels. The camera is the many parallels we see between Joseph and Jesus, and this starts to get to what Bill said. Now I want to be careful. I don't personally go so far as to say that Joseph is a type. Now, you remember that's a bit of a preference statement because I said that I'm very careful on types. There's certainly a lot that is illustrative. And the reason I'm careful on types, remember we said you see a type in the Old Testament, you know for sure it's a type if what?
If the New Testament says it is.
If the New Testament says it is. Okay, so that's our clearest guide if it points back to it. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't a lot of things that are typical or foreshadow things that we're going to see later, okay? A lot of commentators think there are a lot of types. I'm not going to get into a fight about that because I do agree that there are a number of key illustrations and parallels that prefigure key aspects of Christ's incarnation. So what are some of them? Bill mentioned one already. What are some other ones? What are some of the key parallels between Joseph's life and Christ's life?
Obedience.
Obedience, sure, absolutely. That's one. What else?
Falsely accused.
Falsely accused. There you go. The innocent falsely accused. Absolutely. Yeah.
He was hated by his brethren.
Absolutely. Hated by his brethren. Right. Okay. So you guys got it. King. Envy and hatred in the family. Right. So paralleling the religious leaders' envy and hatred of Christ. Right. So Joseph's brothers had a great deal of envy and hatred towards him. And clearly that was the whole case with Christ. Right. He came not only to his earthly family, but to the Jewish family in the nation. So that's kind of the first key parallel. A second one is we saw that Joseph was sold into slavery. Christ was also betrayed by a sale transaction. Of course, we know this was all in his hands and he laid it down, but 20, at least you got 10 more shekels, but the point is 20 shekels in the Old Testament was the price. As you get to Leviticus, you'll see that 20 shekels was the price for a male between 15 and 20 years of age. So it's kind of what the established price was at that point. The rejected becomes the redeemer. Okay, this is a key point. So the rejected one becomes the redeemer, right? So Joseph, certainly not in the same sense as Jesus, but he was a redeemer of his people and protected them. He redeemed all the people through the famine period of time. And then last, kind of God's redirecting man's evil for his good, right? So we have this amazing statement at the end of the book by Jacob, right? I mean, we all would have just been quite as magnanimous, right? Oh, God, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. That's how we generally react when we get wronged, right? That's like way down on 11, 12, 13, maybe down around 99 on my list of things. But the fact of the matter is we see this amazing statement of forgiveness from him, both generally, though, and particularly, okay? So in Joseph's case, he generally provided food for everybody with his foresight for the 7 years of famine, right? And then particularly, he provided for his family, and he was the catalyst to get them down into Egypt and to protect them through the process. Christ, of course, generally died for sin, but particularly for the elect. I'm not going to get into that rubric today. You've heard that enough from the pulpit. So that's kind of one thing. But there's something else, a little more candy in the process. This prefiguring can actually be traced back to Abraham and Isaac as well. And Joseph is just kind of the culmination of it. So zoom out again. And what are the parallels from Abraham's perspective? What does he picture? What does his life picture? It's a little tougher to dig out. What is his life picture?
One man from whom comes the whole tribe of Israel.
Yeah, okay. I think you're kind of on the right track there, but it's God's love and giving up his only begotten son, right? So what did Abraham do, right? He was called on to sacrifice Isaac. So kind of interesting, his beloved son, right, the one he'd waited for, just got him. And the next thing you get is, okay, now that you got him, kill him. Well, that's kind of a rough, you know, command, but he was faithful to that process. And, of course, God prevented that. So you see kind of, you know, Abraham is a parallel, if you will, to God the Father in terms of the only begotten son. Now, followed by Isaac, in what way does Isaac picture kind of a member of the Trinity and an action of the Trinity?
Willing to be sacrificed.
Absolutely right. He was God's willing sacrificial lamb, right? Remember when we went through that? I mean, remember, Abraham's old. Isaac is young and strong. And he allowed his father to bind him and to place him on the altar. So he clearly knew what was coming, but yet we see this kind of willing sacrifice on the part of it. And again, we won't get into what they believed, but I think they believed that he would either provide a substitute, which he did, or that he would resurrect them. Remember when he left from the men that went with him, he said, stay here, wait for us. I and the lad will be back. So Abraham certainly believed something about what God would do, even if he did have to sacrifice him. Yeah, Bill.
You gotta forgive me. This is my first week. You go fast, but I'm not sure.
I'm sorry.
Whether you want interjection.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
In the previous one, it's interesting to note that Jacob's family was in desperate need and unable to take care of themselves. And so Joseph said, if you want to be taken care of, you gotta come to me.
Yeah.
And if you come to me, I'll provide for you.
Yeah.
Which is an absolute perfect picture of Christ.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a great parallel. Yes, and interruptions are always welcome. I always do that. I hear myself talk far too much. But yeah, no, I think that's another great example. I mean, there are oodles of parallels here. And the fact is that he had to come, he had to bring them down. And what else did they have to do? They had to submit themselves, taking Bill's theme a little further, right, to Jacob in the sense, what do we have to do? We have to submit ourselves to the lordship of Christ as well as to the means of salvation. Okay, so we see this kind of second one. And then finally, and fully encapsulated in Joseph, we have three things, right? So the favorite son, we talked about that, right? The favorite son sent by the father to seek his brethren. The innocent son, so Bill mentioned a little earlier this idea of You know, we don't see a big profile of sinfulness in Joseph. Obviously, he did sin, but that's not the focus, whereas the focus has been there for almost all of the other ones, their failings. In Joseph's case, we see his lack of failing and therefore his faith quite significantly on display in the process. The rejected son, right, who becomes the rescuer and the redeemer, and then this whole pattern of Joseph's life, again, prefiguring the treatment of God's messengers in general, right? So even as us, right, we're not prophets, we're certainly not apostles, we're not patriarchs in any way, but you've heard enough preaching from this pulpit about the reception we're going to get in this world, right? Warm and friendly, right?
Yes.
Everybody's ready to embrace us. We want to hear the message. It's all they want to hear, right? Oh, okay. So fact is that God's messengers in general are going to be persecuted. Yes, Amber.
So I have a question about early on in Joseph's childhood, he was given prophetic visions and dreams.
Well, we'll get to that.
Okay, yeah. I just didn't know.
I don't know that early. The only time it's recorded is in this chapter. We'll start to see. Okay, so Joseph is pretty young. He's 17 years old when we start this chapter.
Right.
Okay, so as we get to chapter 17, after we kind of get the context, I mean, not 17, 37. Yeah, so chapter 37, which is we're slowly leading our way into.
I didn't know that was before, and I missed it.
No, you just have to learn we go slow here.
No,
it's part of our age challenge thing. You know, we have to process things a little slower. But no, but teasing aside, it's exactly right. We will see these dreams. Okay, and these dreams are going to be quite prophetic, obviously. Now, whether he fully understood them as such, or whether he was just kind of a youth that was all full of himself, and I'm going to be ruling over you guys, or not, okay, certainly his father understood it, okay, and we'll see, we won't get to the dreams this week, but we'll start with that next week as we get going. Okay, any other questions, comments? And yeah, please, I mean, do interrupt this, Stu, and wave,
well,
whatever.
I'd like to say something if you mind. I think about it because... I would tend to overlook it, typically. But when I reread the story, I'm always struck by how we've kind of watered it down and made it some sort of meaningless metaphor, this whole altar deal.
Mm-hmm.
When in fact, Abraham takes his only son and lays him on the altar and raises the knife to plunge it into his son.
Right.
I mean, we can't even begin to approach that.
Right.
In our thinking, in our doing, we don't come anywhere near that.
Right.
And it's very significant, and yet we kind of just kind of glance over it and say, "Wow, that's cool. He just, you know, he's going to butcher his son."
Yeah. Right. Well, you know, it's a good point, and actually, I like the point. We can even apply it to the whole book, right? And we have these familiar stories, right? And I hesitate to use the word stories because that makes them sound like they're fictional. We have these familiar accounts, right? These historical accounts of God's outworking. I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, I don't think there's anybody in here that he could get as far as even taking him up to the mountain, much less binding him, getting him ready, and picking up the knife, okay? So we overlook those amazing things. You look at the depth of his faith and what he must have been thinking and the torture in his mind versus what he believed about God. You take that. You take this account of Joseph, as we're going to start into, and you think of these dreams. You think of, you know, the different things that happen. And we just think of them as these kind of, oh, aren't these great little stories? Think of Daniel and the lion's den and all these things that we kind of turn into like almost fairy tales, but they're not. It's God's working out through real people in historical time to accomplish his redemptive purposes. So I think it's important to remember those things. Something or just nodding? Bill, okay. All right, so the pattern of his life also prefigures this treatment of God's messengers, and we shouldn't expect to be treated any better in this world. So, pretty cool, but let me conclude by saying again, interesting thoughts and thoughtful illustrations, but I would not press them beyond that. And again, the reason I don't press them beyond that is because nowhere in the New Testament are these indicated to be types. Okay, so... You know, certainly there's correspondence, certainly there's illustrations, certainly nobody's heretical if you make these kinds of observations, okay? But the key to it is to stay kind of within the rails, if you will, right? Because you easily can get outside of the rails and start seeing things that aren't there. Yeah, Bill?
I totally agree with you. I don't think it's a type. that Hebrews 10 says the law is a shadow of the good things to come,
mm-hmm.
and not the very form of things. And the law was the first five books, not
yeah.
Jesus.
Absolutely. Yeah. So you've got that. Yeah. You've also got the, you know, Stephen uses this account quite extensively in Acts 7, right? So he certainly points back to it as part of God's plan as he's working through the whole scenario. I'm just trying to be maybe a little anally precise on types and antitypes. Yeah, so, but, you know, as you read commentaries, and again, the reason I bring these things up to you is not to make a huge point, like I'm right and they're necessarily wrong or vice versa. It's just so you're aware when you read a commentary and you hear what the guys say, okay? You need to read them with a critical eye. So I've told the story a couple times. I remember the first time I was starting out in seminary and the professor was telling me, you know, oh yeah, you can do this stuff. You know more than these guys. I'm like, you got to be like the dumbest guy in the world. I don't know what any of these guys are doing. But then, you know, as you spend time to be in the Lord and you spend time to be in the Word, right? What does it say? We got the best teacher of all inside of us, and that's the Holy Spirit, right? And the fact is, you can understand this. This wasn't written for scholars, right? It was written for ordinary people just like us to understand God and His Word and His outworking, and that's the way we need to approach the Word. You can indeed. Some things Peter says are hard to understand. That's true, but the fact of the matter is, as you're faithfully reading through the Bible, God will reveal things to you. Okay, so, yes.
So when you call something a type,
mm-hmm.
what more does that mean than you're seeing a parallel between Christ and...
Yeah. So a type would follow this language. This is that. That is this. When you see something in the Old Testament that says, this thing that you saw
mm-hmm.
is this thing that's now fulfilled in the New Testament.
So an actual prophecy.
Actual prophecy or event or something. Yeah, Bill.
A good example is the snake being lifted up on the stake.
Mm-hmm.
It,
right.
It says, just as that happened, so it prefigures this.
Mm-hmm.
And so will the Son of Man be lifted up.
Stated.
Right.
Okay.
So it'll be specifically stated, referencing the Old Testament event
mm-hmm.
as saying, that is this, or this is that, okay? Just think
so
of it that way.
So actually pointing to that Old Testament thing and calling it a prophecy as opposed to...
Well, again, it is prophetic in a sense.
Yeah.
It's in that broad category of prophecy, but it's something specific within that called a type. This is a specific prefiguring of something that's called out as that, and we should understand it, okay?
Mm-hmm.
When you see them talk about, you know, things like that, as different from, say, let's say Isaiah 7, when there's the prophecy about the virgin, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's not a type, that's a prophecy, but it's
sure.
specifically said and fulfilled in the New Testament. So
mm-hmm.
they're in that same category of things that the Old Testament is prefiguring.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, some are specific. But the point is, and I think the point of why I wanted to spend the time the way I did this morning is to say, this is a meta, meaning everything. It's a meta narrative, right? 66 books, different authors, but one inspired author. And the fact is that it holds together perfectly. So, you know, as you're doing your read-through, some of you are doing the read-through this year, one of the things to watch for as you're reading through the Bible is how it pins itself together, right? And you can see it. It all makes sense, and it all goes together in the process, okay? So kind of things like that. Does that answer your question?
Sort of, yeah.
Okay. More? It's a big, complicated topic.
Right.
Right? And
okay.
I'm not trying to belittle it or go too quilty over it, but... You know, prophecy, remember, the other thing about prophecy is the lion's share of Old Testament prophecy is foretelling. It's prophets calling Israel to account for their sin and then to repent and turn back to the Lord. When we hear the word prophecy, we tend to jump to the stuff that...
Predicting.
Okay, so foretelling what's going to happen. And they're both important. Right? And I think prophecy is one of the greatest things for the veracity of the Bible, right? Because what happens to the stuff that got predicted?
It happens,
right? Everything that can happen has happened and come true,
mm-hmm.
right? But the fact is that should be a pretty good assurance that those things that have not yet happened will indeed come true just as it was predicted they would. Okay, so it's a big topic, and we can talk more afterwards if you want to. Okay, so just before we leave, let's just take a little kind of biographical sketch of Joseph, kind of preemptively. Would normally do this at the end of it, but kind of what are some of the things you note about Joseph? I heard faithful before. We heard forgiving. I think that's the granddaddy characteristic of him. What else can you think of about Joseph and his character? What comes to mind?
Well,
didn't give up as things went wrong.
Yeah, absolutely right. So the word I use for that is resilient. He's resilient, right? And interestingly enough, I'd say two sides of that teeter-totter. He didn't give up when things went bad, nor did he get cocky when things went well, right? So he was really a balanced guy, steady fella in the process. What else?
Did you say long-suffering?
Long-suffering, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he sure did.
He never complained when things go wrong.
Exactly right. He was not a complainer. Yeah, Bill.
He never got confused and said, I did it. He said, God is the one that interpreted.
Oh, that's a good one. I didn't think about that one. Yeah, yeah. Trusting. Certainly, he seemed to have a great deal of trust. We don't get much on his background. You know, we don't get much on how he was trained, but he demonstrates all that, right? Absolutely. What else? David.
It says explicitly that he was successful because God was with him.
Absolutely right. Okay, so we know he was a follower of Christ or God at that point, which they would have known, and so he's faithful in those things. Okay, anything else? So adaptable.
He was a wise man.
He was a wise guy. Yep, exactly right. Exactly, not a wise guy. That would put him on the what are those mafia shows or whatever. He's not a wise guy, but he was a wise man. Wisdom. Yeah, Bobby.
I don't know that it shows when he's bragging to his brothers about the dreams, but I mean, he'd have to be humble because he still gave God credit. He didn't take the credit.
Yeah, he did. You know, again, remember he's 17 when he's telling these dreams, right? He's probably a bit immature at the time, right? Doesn't quite know how to handle two things about himself, right? One is his father's preferring him. So you're the young pup in the family and pop's putting you on top, right? So that's kind of a tough one. And then he gets these dreams. I mean, he correctly interpreted the dreams. Right, but he was probably a little too bold in perhaps doing those things. So adaptable, he certainly was a man for all seasons. Stable, adversity didn't harden him, prosperity didn't ruin him. Resilient, never complained or compromised. I think that's important, right? He didn't complain, he also didn't compromise. He never compromised in the process. Faithful, seems to have trusted God. And then finally the granddaddy, I mean, he's an amazing picture of forgiveness, isn't he? I mean, he went through a lot of stuff. Right, a lot of ups and downs, and yet all you see is this amazingly forgiving heart in his process. Yeah, oh, Doug?
Just the tail end of Genesis, and when he dies, and then he says, hey, take my phone.
Right.
And you leave, you know, because he knew God was going to fulfill what he had promised.
Exactly right. Yeah.
I find that amazing.
Yeah, wanted to be buried back in the land,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Exactly right. Yeah. What else? Anything? Okay. So there are many implications we can draw from his life, but two kind of strike me in particular. One is the idea that one godly man can make a worldwide impact when we submit to God's providence. Now, we saw this in a non-deified form with Joseph, and obviously with Christ, we saw that as deity. But the fact of the matter is, if you're wondering what your life counts for, well, it can count for a lot. He may not make you a Joseph, but he can make you a Joseph-like figure in whatever sphere that God wants you to be following his providence. And that's really what our witness becomes and becomes important. A second one is the importance of shunning bitterness, right? So I think a lot about that, right? You think about Hebrews in the verse there about, you know, be bitter about nothing and so forth. You know, he never got bitter. I mean, so you really always have two choices, right? You can respond to God's providence in your life with bitterness, right? Look, we've all got stuff. You got this thing with your heart, and you're smiling and wonderful about it, and I think it's great, and I'm sure there's anxiety and anxiousness about that, but, you know, you can't let that root of bitterness take hold, because that's where Satan wants us to be. He wants us to be bitter about that. He wants us to be bitter about what God's bringing into our lives, as opposed to trusting his goodness and thinking of Romans, and God's going to work things together for good. So kind of a couple, any others that kind of strike you about implications about his life? Anything comes to anybody's mind before we go? Okay, so let me kind of recap from last week the outline of these final chapters, and this is kind of how we'll begin to march through it. We'll do this and kind of introduce the first part of the book, and then we'll break it here this week so I can do my little shuttle dance and go up north and do that part. But remember, chapter 37, of course, I had to change some of my P's this week because, you know, that's what we do. We change things from week to week. So in chapter 37, we see this kind of transition from preferred to put out, right? So he goes from this preferred, preferential, privileged position in the family to being put out by the family. In Genesis 38, we see the risk of entanglements. So as we get to Genesis 38, what I'm going to try to suggest to you is it's kind of parenthetical, right? So as you look at 37, even, so if we go back to 35, we ended, Isaac died, right? So the next thing you would expect would be what? The generations of Jacob. But we get this parenthetical to get the generations of Esau to see that God fulfilled his promises. If you took 36 out and read from 35 to 37, it would make sense. Then we get this Joseph story started, and then we kind of have this pause. I mean, this Judah-Tamar thing, it's like, well, what's going on here? Okay, well, I think it's kind of bringing out another point, and we see the point of entanglements with the world. So our broader application or implication is don't get entangled with the world. Okay, God can't use you as well when you're there. So we see this risk of entanglements. 39 to 41, he goes from Potiphar to prison to prime minister. So, and that's a pretty big adventure, right? He goes down, he gets sold into slavery. For any of you who are new, these are all online, so you don't have to write furiously. The slides get put up each week. But from Potiphar, right, he lands with Potiphar. That's where he gets sold. He becomes the chief of the household. Then he gets thrown into prison. Then what happens first thing when he's in prison? What's that?
The dreams.
Well, no, something before the dreams. He does have the dreams. He becomes the head of the prison guys, right? The prison master says, oh, this guy's capable. We'll put him in charge, right? Boom, boom, in charge. Slightly different environment, I expect. And then he gets elevated as a result of the dreams, right, into Pharaoh's court, second most powerful person in the land, okay? So interesting progression there. 42 to 45, we see how he preserves the brothers, particularly, but also everybody with regard to how he administers the famine and the period of the famine. In 46, we finally see the family reunion. Okay, Jacob is finally brought down. The family is together. They're all back together in Goshen, where they're going to grow. In 47, we see the prosperity and posterity, or the growth of the nation in Goshen. Okay, so they become very prosperous, and they grow. 48, we see Joseph's portion. So now in the last three chapters, 48, 49, and 50, we see Jacob's final days and his blessings. Okay, so we're going to see some interesting, prophetic things in there. But first in that is Joseph's portion, kind of the birthright portion to his two sons, a double portion. And then in 49, the first part of chapter 50, we see the patriarchal pronouncements. Okay, so this is Jacob's final blessing for the sons, okay? And he's very prophetic about those things. And we see how we move through that. And then finally, we see this magnanimous pardon, which is where the book ends. And then maybe someday we'll get there. And then maybe someday we'll maybe look at Exodus after that or something else. But, okay, so that's kind of the general layout. What I want to do here, the last part of our time, is just get 37 introduced a bit and kind of look at the key parts here, okay? So this is this part here of from privileged, or I didn't change my title here, from preferred to put out, okay? So 31, verse 1 and 2a really are a transition from Isaac to Jacob's patriarchy, again, told through the life of Joseph, okay? So it's the transition as we're moving into the life of Joseph. Now, 37 to 47 is one long narrative, okay? Remember we had a little excursus at one time on biblical narrative and the structure of biblical narrative. Most of the Old Testament is narrative. We also see poetry in the Old Testament. But narrative, just like we would read a narrative today, follows a process. You introduce it, you see the characters, the scenes are set up, then you have a plot line, it moves to a climax, and then an anticlimax, or the conclusion of the narrative. So this 37 to 47 is one long narrative. Do you have a question, or are you just exercising your arm?
We have to remember that in chapter 38, we're going to see Judah in here.
Yeah, we are indeed. Yeah, we will get there. You're ahead of me by a couple weeks, but we'll get there, I promise. Okay, very good. So 37 to 47 is one big narrative. It's comprised of multiple acts and scenes, okay? So it is classic narrative structure as we read it. Along the way, you're going to see the new acts will be signaled typically by a changing of events and a changing of characters. But throughout the whole thing, Joseph is going to be at the center, with the exception of this one chapter that Danae just told us, chapter 38, and we're going to see about Judah, okay? So acts and scenes, just like you would go to a play today, and you're going to see the various different things. But new characters, new scenes, that you're going to signal that you're changing acts. Each act will have several scenes that develop the plot line. So 37 comprises the first act of the narrative. Okay, it's the first act of the narrative. And as I see it, we see five different scenes, okay, that chart Joseph's progression from preferred to put out. Okay, so it's a progression where he started to how the family puts him out. Now, scene one introduces the overall context for the narrative. And we find that in 2b, or the second part of verse 2 through verse 4. Now, it not only introduces this act, but it also introduces the whole narrative. All right, so it's kind of interesting in terms of how he does that and the amount of detail that we get. In scene two, we see the plot line. Okay, the plot line develops, and it's developed around Joseph's prophetic dreams. Right, so he has two different dreams, and then we're going to see kind of how that establishes how the account is going to move forward. Scene three sets the stage for revenge. Okay, so in 12 to 17, we transition from the dreams to once again Jacob sending Joseph out to check on the brothers. All right, and it kind of introduces us to what's going to happen next in scene four, which is their conspiracy to destroy him and to render his dreams mute. Right, so it kind of reminds me of the story in the New Testament when we talk about the landowner sets it up, puts people in, moves away, sends his people back to get his portion. What happens? Boom, kill him. Send another group, boom, kill him. Well, I'll send my son. Surely they won't kill him. Now, that's a much bigger picture here. But the idea here is that there's a conspiracy. They think they can stop God's plan by eliminating God's instrument in the process. Okay, but God sticks his hands in there and prevents that. And then finally in scene five, which concludes the first act, we end with the family's distinctive birthmark, right? What is the birthmark of this family? They just got deception written all over them. So finally, we see them deceiving Jacob, right? Which is kind of ironic, right? They're going to do with goat's blood. How was he deceived? With goat's what? Hair, okay? And goat's meat, okay? So you kind of see this thing kind of traversing through that. So that's how it lays out. Let's just read the first four verses, and we'll get started with those. Somebody read those for me, please.
Now Jacob lived in the land where his father had sojourned, in the land of Canaan. These are the records of the generations of Jacob. Joseph, when 17 years of age, was pasturing the flock with his brothers while he was still a youth, along with the sons of Bilhah and sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought back a bad report about them to their father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his sons, because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a varicolored tunic. His brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, and so they hated him and could not speak to him on friendly terms.
Okay, so we get the narrative picking up. Genesis 37 picks up the storyline from 35:29, which helps us again see that this 36 was parenthetical. And they set the context for the whole narrative that'll happen in 37 to 47. To me, it is notable for its brevity. I mean, we get the barest of details, but the essentials, right? So it's almost as if Moses is breathless and he wants to get on the story and he just wants to paint the barest of details so the account will make sense. Nevertheless, we do get some details about what's going to go on. Now, what are some of the key things we're told in verses 1 to 4? What's some of the facts we get about the account that's going to follow? What are we told? Kind of pick it up in 2b mainly, right after these are the generations. Well, you can start in 1. So what are we told? What are some key facts?
17.
17 years old, that's right. What else?
He was pasturing the flock.
Okay, so he's working as a shepherd. Yeah, what else?
Yes,
he snitched on
him. Yeah, yeah. We'll get into some debate on that one. Did he really snitch or not? Yeah, okay, right? He did snitch or didn't. He certainly brought a report back, right? What else?
Dad's favorite,
yeah. What else?
Brothers had two feelings, jealousy and envy.
Yeah, absolutely, right? We see some really emotional, strong emotions from the brothers. What else? He had a coat of many colors. Okay, right. So, good job. You kind of see it. It's key. I mean, we do get some facts, okay? First is that Jacob had finally settled in the land, all right? So that's where we start. He's in the land, and he's settled down. He's where he's supposed to be. Joseph was 17, and he was working as a shepherd. Now, why the qualifier while he was still a youth? It says he was a shepherd, but it says while still a youth. Kind of in the opinion category here. Okay, so I think to suggest that he was an apprentice shepherd, okay, he was still young. He's the youngest guy. Remember his brother Benjamin, he's just a pup. He's back home, right? So you got 10 or you got the 11 of the 12 in the field. It also might explain why he's associated with Bilhah and Zilpah, right? So there's kind of the big group from Leah. Probably when they're out in the field, they figure they're preeminent because they're Leah's children. Then you've got the two concubines, and then this is the child of promise through Rachel in the process. So you've got that. He seemed to be aligned with these lesser siblings, okay? And we have this note that he reported on his brothers. Now, the question is he snitching? Is he reporting? We're not really told, right? We're just told that he brings back a report. Now, why he did that, we don't know, okay? Jacob preferred Joseph. Why does it say that he preferred him? Son of his old age, okay. So he was the son of his old age, but I suspect a bit more because he was the son of his beloved wife, Rachel, okay. I think there is an implication here, okay. So if any of you had the pleasure of maybe having a couple of kids and then maybe an oopsie or another plan one many years later. The fact is I have a 10-year younger sister. I always teased my parents was an oopsie, and they told me no, it was not. But the fact of the matter is, you know, a child later in life will sometimes be raised rather differently than a child younger in life, okay? So it's kind of something to remember and think about, and even as we're grandparents, we can still be parenting grandchildren. So Jacob displayed his preference via this royal robe, and that's really what it is, okay? It's a full-length robe, very colored, is kind of a... It's an unfortunate translation. Most of them do. It doesn't say very colored, but it is a robe that denotes a sense of royalty or leadership or preference, okay? So it is noted for that. And the favoritism was not hidden, right? So his father didn't hide the favoritism, which resulted in hatred and isolation, right? So there's some key things that we learn in the process, and we get some baseline. We have a sense of why what happens as we get these facts to get started. Now, are there any questions kind of left in your mind after you read these first four verses? What else would you might have wanted to know?
What did he snitch about?
Yeah, what did he snitch about? Or why did he snitch, okay? That was certainly one of the questions in my mind. I mean, what prompted him to make this report? It doesn't tell us that he was told to make a report. Yeah?
I never really thought of it until today, but because they were mean to him?
Yeah, sure. Could be. I don't know. Maybe they're mean. Maybe they didn't like him. Yeah, Amber.
Usually my younger children can spot sin very quickly. My older sons, they can just go, you know, he's sinning, he's not being nice.
Because it's a good defense, right? It works. Mom,
yeah.
He's sinning. Okay, yeah, you got that. Right? So why? And that would explain it, I think, kind of. Yeah, self-righteousness, absolutely. Yeah, that could be it, some things like that. So a couple things. Jacob, did he not learn anything about the effects of favoritism? He repeats exactly what he had. Does he recognize what he's doing to Joseph by putting him in that position? I mean, it's pretty kind of a tough. Yeah, probably not. Why does Moses add along with the sons? And we talked about that. And then what compelled Joseph to initiate the bad report? And who was it actually directed towards? Was it the sons of Zilpah and Bilhah only? Was it the whole gang? I mean, so there's things that we are not told, but what is our answer to why we're not told? because decided it wasn't important for what he wanted us to know. But you can have an active mind to think through those kinds of things. So at the outset, we see this pattern of sibling rivalry that marks the book, right? It's alive and well. Started with Cain and Abel, right? Resulted in murder. Continued with Jacob and Esau. Culminates with Joseph and the ten. I say ten because his brother Benjamin's at home, so he's not part of this cabal at this point in time. The emotions of such things are quite strong, right? Led to murder with Cain and Abel. Estrangement between Jacob and Esau. And at least at the outset, they were going to do murder, but Simeon, in his wisdom, decided they ought to go a different play, and we'll get to that and why. So, some implications. Joseph's partiality dooms his family really to the same strife that he experienced, okay? So, it's a good reminder for us not to repeat the sinful patterns of our parents. Bill?
Can't help but chuckle because Jacob's brother was the favorite of his father.
Right.
Therefore, it's the exact opposite.
Exactly right. So, you see these ironies as you're moving through it. You see this idea of not repeating the sins of your fathers. But I would also underscore the fact that you're not destined to repeat those sins, okay? What do you hear all the time? Pat, do you have sons? Or you just...
You know, one of the things, too, is it shows how destructive jealousy is.
Oh, yeah.
Because in Proverbs where it says, wrath is fierce, mm-hmm. and anger is a flood.
Right.
Well, those things will go away.
Right.
But who can stand before jealousy?
Exactly right. Yeah, very good point, right? I mean, jealousy is that thing that develops that bitter root. It gets you thinking. It takes you, I think of James 1, right? Starts with desire. Yeah, Bill?
Yeah, but if you cause the jealousy, where does the sin start?
Yeah, that's right. Starts somewhere else, perhaps, right? So, yeah, but you do see that sense, right? So you see it kind of building in there, and then it outworks itself in various different things. Favoritism really doesn't do the recipient any favors, right? Because, as we just saw, it draws the envy and jealousy of others. It isolates and endangers the recipient. It can place someone in a position they're too immature to handle. I mean, he's 17. He's the young guy. He can't handle this, all right? And ultimately, it's going to separate you from the object of your favoritism, right? So we talked about patterns, right? What did it result in with Rebecca, right? Favoritism, what happened? Sent her away. She never saw him again. Right, so it ultimately can separate you from the object of your favoritism. So a couple things. So with the context set, we're going to move into scene 2, where we get to the narrative's plot line, and this is where we're going to stop today. I'm not going to read it, but you're going to get some homework. So as you read the rest of the chapter, I want you to be thinking about a few things, okay? Make sure I don't put these slides up so you get all the answers before you come back next week. So a couple things, right? Think about the two dream metaphors and what they symbolize beyond just his superiority. So clearly both dreams talk about the supremacy of Joseph. But think about the two metaphors that are used and see if there's any other significance. Secondly, think about why Reuben intervenes to present the murder of Joseph. Okay, so the first plan is to murder him. But Reuben, right, the firstborn, intervenes and says, no, let's not shed blood. Think about why he might have taken that position. Thirdly, think about why Judah takes the lead in the scheme to sell Joseph into slavery. Okay, so you got Reuben first, and then Judah takes center stage in terms of the scheme to ultimately sell him into slavery. So think about why would Judah have taken that lead. Remember, all the brothers are there, okay? And then finally, I already blew this one for you, think about the irony of goat's blood, okay? Used to deceive Jacob. Of course, the irony is that's the same stuff that he was deceived by earlier, or his father was deceived by him in terms of using the goat. Okay, so as you read it, think about those things. Think about what the two dream metaphors symbolize. Think about why Reuben sticks his nose in it. Think about why Judah sticks his nose into it at the point that he does. And then we'll kind of pick it up here next week. Okay, Amber.
What are some commentaries that the straw leaders recommend?
And this one? There are a bunch
not
of them.
Cheat, but just to...
Yeah, no, it's... it's kind of stylistic.
Yeah.
There's a guy I like called Leupold, H.C. Leupold. He's old, very old. I look at 5 or 6 different ones to get different things, so I can send you a note of what those are. You can get a sense of what they are. I try to look at conservative ones and liberal ones, so I understand what both sides are saying in the process. But I also want to tell you that I look at this commentary first, and I form my own opinions before I go to those books. Okay, now, not always right by any means, but they're good resources. Don't start with them. Love John MacArthur. Love the study notes. Try not to read like this. Right? Unless you want to read Chinese, which goes like this or something like that. Okay? So, you know, try to form your own opinions. Think these things through. And, yeah, it's okay to look at commentaries afterwards. David, would you close us up in a word of prayer, please?
Sure. Heavenly Father, we thank you for your word, which you preserved for our instruction, that we may have hope. Lord, we pray that we would be encouraged to imitate examples of righteous men and women.